It's the Wonky Show. England is grappling with Labour's long-term aspirations for HE. We'll figure out what it wants. OFS wants to silence the boomers. We'll have a listen to its new boss, and regional access and participation planning is coming. We'll get across that. It's all coming up.
And I thought it was the clear message here was we don't think universities are doing well enough in these five areas, and we expect you to do more. And I think the final one on sustained efficiency and reform programme, that makes me feel that the way you fund the first four is to be a more efficient.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. This week we're here live in Senate House in London for our Festival of Higher Education, where over 500 of the sector's biggest names have come together to get across the future of the sector. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to enjoy their novelty conference socks, as usual, three terrific guests. Vicky Stott is Chief Exec at the Quality Assurance Agency. Vicky, your highlight of the conference?
Oh, well, I sadly couldn't be with you yesterday, so I arrived this morning. My absolute highlight was listening to Alec Usher, whose blog I've been reading ever since I was knee-high to a high knee, I think. So I fangirled a bit.
Yeah, Alec Usher, Canadian HE expert, linked to his blog and his terrific podcast, although not quite as good as ours was. In the show notes. Also with us is Alistair Jarvis, Pro Vice Chancellor, Partnerships and Governance at our partners for the festival, University of London. Alistair, your highlight of the event?
Probably the session with David Behan yesterday from the OFS, and just a really sort of refreshing, different sort of tone from the OFS, engaging, kind of clear, honest. And I think we're going to come on a bit to points for him later.
Yeah. More of that later. And also with us, Michael Salmon, news editor at Wonky. Michael, your perhaps behind the scenes highlight of the event.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the pub quiz last night. Came second, I was pleased with. But actually, I just did a session on how to read the HE news to a, not packed house because it was at lunchtime. But, I really enjoyed doing it, and hopefully some of the audience got something out of it.
Yes, do write for us. Get your views out there. Great stuff. Now, we'll start this week then with Labour. Bridget Phillipson has written to the sector. Michael, what did she have to say, both in that letter and in her statement to Parliament?
Yeah, so this had when we recorded the show last week, this had just happened. This is really the setting what the next year is going to look like. So we thought we'd look at it again, because there's lots in there. So, there was the tuition fee rise, maintenance loans, but, perhaps more important is this longer term set of things that Labour said it wants to work in collaboration with the sector and with sector bodies on. And she set out five things that, Labour wants from universities. And she wrote to vice chancellors, said it in Parliament. So they are, to refresh everyone's memories, she wants universities to play a stronger role in expanding access and improving outcomes for disadvantaged students. She wants universities to make a stronger contribution to economic growth and play a greater civic role. And to raise the bar further on teaching standards, drive out poor provision, all that kind of stuff. And then the last one is this efficiency and reform program, which we did speak a bit about last week. I think the interesting thing, which I didn't really appreciate when I first read the letter, she says that the DfE wants to work in partnership with the science department, with UKRI, the OFS and the sector to shape the changes to government policy that will be needed to support these changes, these sort of aspirations. And some kind of plan is coming by next summer, but really it sort of suggests the next 2-3 months is the moment for these conversations and these discussions and debates to be had.
Now Alistair, we can certainly at Wonky, we can overanalyze this sort of stuff. As a piece of textual analysis, we'll spend hours pulling apart the sentence construction. But what is the mood music telling us in terms of this kind of sense of a deal that is being about to be struck?
Two things. I think firstly, the fact that there was a modest fees increase and modest maintenance loan increase is at least an acknowledgement for the Labour government that there are some issues to address. It's not going to address the issues, of course not. It's a small short term sticking plaster, but it is an acknowledgement. I think though the real game in town is what happens next. And I thought the letter was less about funding and more about reform. And you look at the five areas and you first read them So doing the kind of wonky thing about, you know, looking at them, the snapshot, and then looking at the detail afterwards, you first read them and think, well, these are all kind of good things. You know, why wouldn't you want to have a big civic contribution? Why wouldn't you support access? You know, even efficiency and reform. Well, you know, that's kind of something that you'd expect universities to be efficient. Obviously, strong economic growth. You know, these are good things. The problem is, I don't think there's any more money coming. Or if it is, it's going to be pretty moderate. So there's a real risk here for universities that you end up with a government that is asking universities to do more in all of these areas, but without any more support to do it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the clear message here was we don't think universities are doing well enough in these five areas, and we expect you to do more.
Yeah.
And I think the final one on sustained efficiency and reform program, that makes me feel that the way you fund the first four is to be a more efficient. So they've given you the answer in number five. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's really worrying because there are, you know, we all know there are universities that are really on the brink.
Yeah. Vicky, let me, the fourth one, improved teaching standards to address underperformance. Now, obviously, we have to determine what underperformance and performance is and then, yeah, and so on.
I know someone who can help you with that.
Yes, sure. then you have to find it. But is it the case that fundamentally an agenda which is about efficiency, and you'd have to assume, given where most of the sector's staff spend is, you know, a different sort of understanding on what an acceptable staff-student ratio is that in tension with improved teaching standards?
I mean, it is in tension with improved teaching standards, and this is something we've been saying for some time at QAA, that you know, it would be stupid to try to pretend that financial crisis doesn't impact on absolutely every aspect of university provision, and quality and teaching standards obviously are critical aspects, and they will be affected at some point. But I think when I was reading the letter, what I really noticed was what Mark Steer was saying earlier today. There is a real sense in here that universities are on the wrong side of the social justice divide for this government, and they talk very compellingly about their personal histories and their personal circumstances. And I think we need to be listening to those messages and talking about how what we do can address their concerns, yeah, rather than worrying about proving what we've always done or getting better at the things we're used to doing.
Yeah. And Michael, this, you know, in some ways you'd have to, you know, this thing we've talked about on the podcast before, that there are not too many graduates. It's just that there might not be, there might be too many graduates in the wrong place having studied the wrong things. You know, to some extent that would get covered in what? Stronger alignment with economic growth and skills needs. But in a market demand led system.
Yeah. Does this mean
we have to contemplate system rule changes? Do you know what I mean?
That question that, yeah, as you say, we're always going on about, you know, what is the government's vision? We talked about this under the Tories. What does the government actually want the size and shape of the sector to be? Where does it want it to be? Who does it want it to be for? You know, the different levels. It doesn't feel like we're quite getting down to that yet. I think by mentioning things like access, civic, teaching quality, and whatever the other one was, you know, these things are sort of, you know, they don't necessarily require wholesale reform, right? All of these things will need some kind of policy announcement so that the government can say, you know, at some point in a year's time, it'll come up in education questions. Someone will say, do you remember those five things you said? And they'll say, yeah, on number one, this is what's happened. Number two, this is what's happened. You know, so for example, driving out poor practice, that might just look like the announcement on franchising that we'll get in January, right? You know, and say, you know, the access and participation thing, that may be, you know, what sort of John Blake's thinking around access. There may be a little bit of money there and that would be it. So it could just be that, but it you know, maybe more optimistically, there's a chance for some sort of, you know, interesting policy conversations. I do think Alistair's right that all of these things need to be, you know, the sector has an opportunity to make its case to DfE and the rest and the Treasury about things it can do in this agenda that's not going to require additional money. I don't see that as a sort of subtext to this letter.
But this is, the interesting question, Alistair. So if you think about the sort of, you know, the wider tertiary thing, yeah, the big questions about where universities are, how many we need in relation to how many FE colleges there are. So that whole thing, We don't feel like we're yet even being teed up to have that conversation, which actually was telegraphed in the manifesto.
It was. Funny enough, I was just going to come back to the manifesto. And I think anyone that thinks that these are sort of five vague priorities that Labour are kind of going to nod towards and then kind of forget about, I think it's forgetting what it said in the manifesto. I mean, it was probably the most stark statement in the whole manifesto in any different type of topic. It said the ATE funding system is broken. And it said this is not good for students, for taxpayers, or for universities. I mean, that's pretty stark.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a very modest fee rise and a very modest maintenance grant rise and five vague priorities is not... is not a credible government response if that's your view. And I think that's a pretty deep-seated review, a deep-seated view within government. However, I really don't think they've got the answer. So I think in terms of what the size should be, what the shape should be, I don't think they've made up their mind. I think they are absolutely clear that they're not happy with what we have now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the review could be in 3 years' time. You know, there's a long way to go in this parliament. Like, you know, I think this is a sort of 12-month agenda, and it is, yeah. As you say,
Mickey, we often forget that the Mickey Mouse degree allegation was actually a Labour minister allegation well before it was sort of adopted by the Conservatives. Should the sector with its partners be offering up some action on where there's poor quality, or should the position be broadly how it's been for many years now, which is, well, show me a bad quality course. Do you know what I mean? That's sort of what proved that there's a bad... Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I think, you know, there are two kind of aspects to that question, Jim, aren't there? That the universities do review their own provision. They do their own internal quality assurance on a cyclical basis, however they choose to do that. And that's one thing. The other thing is, should the sector face up to what we believe to be pockets of poor provision? We've begun to see a really interesting model for that, how that might happen in the evaluation of international foundation years that we did on the behest of the Quality Council earlier this year. And I think that provides a really interesting model for the sector to say, look, there might be something to look at here. Let's get somebody sensible external to do it under a kind of mandate that's given by the sector together across all four of the nations. So it's not just any nation specific. It's not specific to any regulatory framework, but it really is a collective demonstration of the sector taking ownership of its own stuff. And led by somebody who is, you know, going to say if there's something wrong, not going to sweep it under a carpet. And then as a sector, we agree that we're going to respect that and do something about it so that we can head off regulatory interest.
And Michael, just before we come off this, Rachel Wolfe has written for us this week, has she not?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Rachel Wolfe from Public First has been thinking a bit more about the sort of, you know, we could say simplistically the comms side of it, which I think this letter is a way into, not so much the actual policy questions, but just, you know, how well are universities faring in the court of public opinion and the court of government opinion? You know, and she says essentially that both the budget and the sort of, you know, in big terms, slim pickings in the HE reform statement that we got, should suggest that universities are not quite quite well aligned with Labour's wider agenda. You know, this thing about working people, you know, whoever they may be, about communities, it's not quite how the sector speaks about itself in the broadest brush terms. Obviously, you know, I think the sector thinks it actually does do that quite well. But in terms of what cuts through to the government and perhaps to, you know, some of the most influential commentators and papers, you know, she argues, you know, I think there's some truth in it, that more needs to be done on that and less needs to be done in sort of abstract, you know, what happens if you add up all the spending?
The economic contribution.
Yeah, exactly.
Type stuff. Yeah. Excellent. Well, look, plenty more on the site on all of this. Now, live, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi everyone, I'm David Galani, Head of Student Engagement and Advocacy at Middlesex University. And this week on the site, I've been blogging about understanding our students and how they develop a sense of belonging at university. It's been a hot topic in the sector for a while, especially since the Wonky and Pearson research in 2022. And universities have rightly since then been doing a lot of practical work, student voice feedback and research around student sense of belonging. In addition to surveys being used to explore how students develop that sense of belonging at scale, we found that quite a few universities have been using and introducing innovative, qualitative methods to gain a richer understanding of their students in this way. To explore this, Sophie Connor, a grad intern at the University of Leeds, led a research project to pull together some of this practice from listening rooms, online diaries, card sorting techniques, and reverse mentoring. The research report highlights how universities are using these methods and in an accessible way. We hope the blog and associated report gives people confidence to use some of these methods to explore students' sense of belonging beyond just the traditional means.
Now, students should be part of the teams that visit universities and be part and parcel of how the assessments and the judgments are actually made, the interim chair of the Office for Students said yesterday. Now, Alistair, you're a boomer.
Am I a boomer? I'm not sure if I quite am, but anyway. David Feehan's comments yesterday at the Festival of Higher Education, I think, were fascinating. And so two things struck me. First was quite how strong his views were on students being right at the heart of regulation. And actually, I think it's a stronger signal than we've heard before from the OFS. You know, he sort of said it's not enough to consult students. Students actually need to be part of the teams, effectively making regulatory decisions. So that, you know, really jumped out. The other thing that really jumped out at me was just overall how measured, authoritative, experienced, sort of calm he was. And it felt like a very different style and tone from the OFS. And frankly, it left me feeling it's a shame that he's only the interim chair. Because actually, it gave me a feeling that we've got some sort of stability in a regulator. And, you know, it's a regulator that's felt to me like it's been in startup mode for now many years. And it should now be a relatively mature regulator, but still feels a bit like a startup.
Yeah.
And actually, the tone and approach he took made me suddenly think, gosh, we've got a chair here who's sort of, you know, somebody you can kind of trust and rely on. It felt good. But unfortunately, he's only around for a few more months, and they're already advertising for his successor.
Well, look. The job ad is out, Alistair. I'm sure you'd be released. Now, Vicky, this thing about students actually being part of the judgments being made. This must be music to your ear.
It absolutely is. Yes. Yes. I mean, it's the sensible way to do it. It's the way that everybody else does it. It's a really welcome recognition that students are expert in their own experience, and they should be asked about it, and they should be listened to when they talk about it, and they should be part of the team that forms judgments. Mm. Brilliant.
And he did this vivid thing, didn't he? I mean, let's hear a clip.
I do worry about a bunch of people in their later years making decisions about younger people without any of those younger people being in the room. I'm just not sure if that was ever sustainable. It is sustainable. I sit on a number of boards, and the majority of the boards I sit on, people are in their 50s and 60s, talking very often in the jobs that I've got about people in the 20s. And I'll be long retired before those people in the 20s are in the middle of their careers. Actually, I think we just need that voice, the people, to help people begin to shape their future, not just allowing the baby boomers the space to actually have their voice. That voice needs to be tempered by younger people. So I think it's a bigger issue that we need to get to grips with. And again, I come back to some of the things I've already touched on, Mark, of the information asymmetry, particularly about information, the transparency of the contracts, the kind of sense of what people are getting for the money. What was really interesting going around, I was at university between 1974 and 1978. It was a different world. It was a different time.
And that is fascinating, isn't it? Because, you know, to some extent, he's reflecting on being in not just higher education, but in all sorts of settings where clients or customers or patients or whatever are being talked about, but aren't in the room.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this reflects the sort of maturity that Alistair was just talking about. With him at the helm of the regulator, they can take that kind of mature position and they can really move forwards in a constructive way with the sector, with students. And I think that's absolutely to be welcomed.
Yeah. Now, Michael, one of the things that perhaps was surprising was, as well as doing the sort of shtick that we know he's done over the summer on student contracts and students as consumers and all of that kind of stuff, he actually mentioned the fee increase thing and whether or not universities have given themselves the kind of contractual right to actually increase fees for continuing students. Just rehearse for us what's going on there.
Yeah, so he said this issue around the implementing the fee rise should be a driver of greater transparency, which is very interesting. Something we've been and you've been exploring a lot on the site. So for those who've maybe missed this in the sort of onslaught of other takes on the fee rise that we've had, there's a question whether students who are all, you know, undergraduate students who are already at universities and have signed a contract with the institutions, you know, there's a sort of consumer rights question about whether these fee rises can actually be implemented without falling foul of, you know, consumer protection law. And as your piece looks through, there's not a standard student contract, and universities badge this in different ways. Some will say, you know, there may be an increase from inflation, some sort of say, I don't know, like, oh, they might go up, you know, by this much or maybe a bit more, you know, it depends. But things can be a little bit vague. The interesting thing is also that this happened already in Wales last year. They increased their fee cap from 9,000 to 9,250. Some universities, based on their language in their contracts, felt that they couldn't apply this to their existing students. So they now have a sort of differential fees system in certain universities. So it is kind of interesting that English universities didn't get on top of it, because we knew a fee rise of some sort was coming, really. On the other hand, I am not really sure, and you maybe can spell it out for us if there's an answer, but, you know, what would a compliant contract say, given that it's a fee cap? The government doesn't set the fees, they set the cap, and also that they do it based on a projection of inflation that might be wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, having looked at it, my actual guess is that it's genuinely very difficult to raise fees for continuing students for all sorts of reasons beyond inflation, and it has to be inflation, I think, rather than the OBR's guess on what inflation's going to be.
But that's exactly,
you know, that, to some extent, that's a technical debate. But what I was going to ask you, Alistair, was one of the things it seems to me is if you take, for example, this fees thing, in Labour's head, in the public's head, in students' head, the government sets the fee, not the maximum. Government sets the fee. Similarly, I think in Labour's head, in the public's head, in university's head, it is having to make significant savings, probably get rid of lots of optional modules and all sorts at the moment in order to cut its cloth. Both of those are potentially in conflict with a set of consumer rights that OFS is now saying it's going to more rigorously and proactively enforce. That backs the regulator into quite a corner, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You're getting right to the heart of the challenge of the design of the current funding system, that it was created with the aspiration that there'd be a diversity of fee levels. But of course, universities acted like rational actors and all went up to the maximum. And of course, students followed the higher prices when there was a little bit of diversity, because the sort of price gave a signal of quality. And so actually you're going right fundamentally to, have we got a funding system that is structured correctly? And that makes it incredibly difficult to regulate, because the regulation and the funding are not really in tune with each other.
Vicky, I guess the other thing that was quite interesting towards the end of David's comments was, I think he said that elite universities recruiting students that would have been traditionally served by teaching intensive universities was not very collaborative. Now, is that a signal that the regulator would want to see more system level concern when people are making decisions about who they recruit? Or
is that not like in direct tension with the ambition for universities to generate social mobility, to improve their access, to widen participation? I mean, how do we carry on squaring these completely conflicting circles?
Yeah.
I think, you know, students should be able to access elite, if we're going to accept that term, universities, highly competitive universities, based on their ability to succeed there, not on whether or not they come from a background where they would more traditionally go to a teaching intensive university. That's just nonsense that runs in the face of every other policy intent. Also not a boomer.
But Michael, it is of course the case, isn't it, that at one point OFS was debating whether or not in highly selective universities to go for a target of expansion to achieve fairness.
Yes.
Or to kick some of the middle classes out of highly selective universities to achieve fairness. And the deadline for making a decision on which KPM to pick passed, and then John Blake took the reins, yeah, and then yeah, the debate evaporated. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So that kind of classic Telegraph headline, you know, are these access targets driving out my kid? You know, that thing was kind of fudged. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that Behan's comments at the end there were a sense that we're gonna ride that horse, but this is still in play, isn't it? This question of what do we mean by fair access?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be many people within the sector or elsewhere who would argue with the idea that students from this, you know, the, it, you know, the sort of Robbins principle, but on an institutional level, that, you know, students should be able to get into the universities that have the ability to teach them. But, I mean, there are other questions just beyond putting students in abstract into the courses and the institutions whose admission criteria, you know, flexibly applied, they benefit from. There's questions around classroom space. There's questions around teaching staff. And, that, you know, there's questions about accommodation that you may have read about. And, you know, that, but for a regulator that's been told that really, first and foremost, it is to attend to the financial stability of the sector, not of, you know, individuals, but, you know, and how well certain institutions do, but the sector as a whole, one consequence of the government telling it to do that necessarily needs it to be kind of worrying about the institutions that have lost out in recruitment cycles.
One, and just on that, Alistair, one thing that I thought was very interesting is that to some extent we revisited the question of bailouts and failing institutions with the chair of the Office for Students, as we had done, as Mark had done, you know, a few years ago at Wonkfest with Michael Barber when he was chair. And as you'll recall, Bahan effectively said, well, we don't want to be running a bailout fund because that might then start to cloud our judgments about what we say and don't say about all sorts of things, but both quality and that was an interesting kind of few minutes, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I think when it comes to bailouts, it comes far more to politics than to what the sort of policy or regulatory structures are. You know, there are certainly universities in this country that if they were going to fail, the government would intervene with some kind of package to rescue them.
Yeah.
So I always take a bit with a pinch of salt what any regulator says about bailouts, because I think a political reality takes over. And actually, if you look sort of back through kind of decades of examples where government has intervened to support universities, sometimes quietly and behind the scenes, it has usually been a political direction from a minister who has asked then what would have been in the past the funding council and now the regulator to intervene specifically in a certain case because there was a political decision that was the right thing to do. So I think we can get a little bit, I think we go down a bit of a rabbit hole by thinking what's the bailout structure.
Yeah.
I think there's another very valid question though, is how do you prevent getting to the stage where bailouts are needed? And I think there are programs, mechanisms, structures you could put in place to try and limit the number of bailouts that will ever be needed.
Yeah.
But I think the simple question of do you bail out a university, it will be a political decision. And if it is seen as politically right to do it, money will be found and the regulator, frankly, will be told to bail them out.
Yeah.
Or indeed, it could be done directly by government. It doesn't have to go through EFS.
And he was pretty clear, wasn't he, on what effectively is the sort of role of a regulator and the role of government. Let's have a clip.
It's not for the Office for Students as a regulator to bail out, in inverted commas, higher education organisation. I don't think any regulator should be given the job of providing, in inverted commas, bailout money. What I did say in the review was that the OFS needed to work much more collaboratively and much more in partnership, partly with central government, the FEE and DSIT on the research side, because the route to any public support, any public finance, will come through those departments to the Treasury. And I also don't want OFS making judgments based on whether they can pay a bailout sum. Yes, we'll do this because we've got some money, or no, we're not going to do it because that's difficult. I think there is a job for central government. I think it's to set the financial resources and the financial envelope within which the higher education sector can work. I know some universities, and this won't be available to all, have funds that they can access. They might be from the private sector. They might be money that's been left to them historically that they've got invested that they can actually use. So not every organisation is in exactly the same position. But I don't think it is something that the OFS should do. What it should do is work collaboratively with central government. And indeed, Mark, that's what's been happening in some of the conversations. I think our job is to do that assessment of financial sustainability at both a sector level as well as at an individual level. And that was behind my recommendation that one of the priorities for OFS should be about financial sustainability. And I think that intelligence should then be shared on a confidential basis. I think that really needs to be held confidentially with central governments, so they can have their conversations about preparedness to invest any resources, if that's indeed a judgment that they think they need to make. So far, I think there are three organisations that have been registered with the OFS that have closed because they're not financially sustainable. And I don't think there is a large institution that's going to close imminently. But you only have to read your press or the Times Higher Education press to work out who's in trouble and who's had to make some quite dramatic adjustments to the budgets, to the priorities, and indeed to the offer. So I think this is a really important role for the OFS going forward. And as I understand the way that the NICS cost and the increase in fees money is worked through, that's not even in balance in a number of institutions. The costs are greater than the additional income coming through.
Now, Vicky, one other thing. The Office for Students has press released that it's joining a club that you convene today. Just explain what's going on there.
Well, I am also president of the International Network of Quality Assurance Agencies for Higher Education, which is, as the name suggests, an international network. And any quality assurance provider with a 5-year track record of having some kind of mandate and a 2-year track record of doing review work of some sort is eligible to apply for membership. Yeah. And we are really delighted, actually, to welcome OFS into the body of membership and to see them participating on kind of international discussions around quality and joining in with fora that think about how to improve quality for students across the globe. I think it's really good news.
Yeah, I mean, notwithstanding it's somewhat technical, but it's also, important that question about whether or not its current arrangements are sort of, broadly, comparable with, other systems and so on. He made quite an interesting kind of defense of the idea of quality assurance and regulation. I thought it was interesting because talking to Alex Usher from Canada this morning, he was effectively saying, I don't understand why you're so obsessed with quality of regulation. We basically have none of it in Canada and we're fine, thanks. If you'd have been responding to Alex this morning, what would you have said?
I was in the room when he said that and I thought, that's a really good point. And actually, a long way away from listening to Alex's very sound advice, the rest of the world is stampeding towards more regulation, more examination, more alignment. So, and I can see him sitting behind you smirking quietly. So while calm down, back off is really good advice in the sort of regulatory space, I think. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon either.
Every week on the show, we look back at how things were and how things came to be with academic registrar and sector historian Mike Radcliffe. Live is the hidden history of HE.
So one of the things I think is interesting about the history of higher education is it is the history of change. We change in higher education. And sometimes you can look at higher education and you think, oh, we're perfect. But then if you go back into the past, you can find people who thought it was perfect then and we have changed. So it's important that we focus on that. And one of the things that Alistair did in his welcome to us yesterday was talk about one of the key things the University of London did was it was one of the first places to admit women to degrees. And one of the big things we can do if we're looking back over the history of higher education is accept there was a time when particularly men thought it was entirely sensible that women should play no part whatsoever in higher education. And therefore, they were completely excluded. Now, I've got some great examples of regulations specifying exactly how excluded they've got to be. So we get a change in higher education. We get a change in thinking. In the beginning of the 19th century, that coincides with the development of the University of London. And what the University of London does out of that special decision to be an examining university looking after two colleges is it allows the prospect of a college to be formed that consists of women. And so Bedford College is set up in the 1840s. It's very small scale over in Bedford Square, but it starts to educate women. And there's a slow pressure for those women to be admitted to the university, admitted to take exams. Emily Davis is wanting to set up a college. She advances the argument that in order to for her students to excel, she wants them to take the exams. And so she pressures the universities to just let her have copies of the examination papers so that her ladies could take the same exams that the men are taking. And they eventually decide there's no good argument that they cannot just give them a copy of the exams.
Something weird's happened. Go on. Carry on.
So there's no reason why they couldn't just have copies of the exams. And so she gets her students to take them. She sets up a college. She puts it in Hitchin to start with, halfway between London and Cambridge. But finally, she moves it to Girton in 1869 and then continues to pressure people for the ability for her students to educate alongside the men or in the same kind of a way. Such that we know that in 1897, Philippa Fawcett takes the maths tripos, the most important exam at Cambridge, and does better than all the men in her year. She would have been that the best mathematician at Cambridge was called the senior wrangler. She would have been the senior wrangler. She was best at the people who took that exam that year. So it shows where their problem is. Cambridge has a big vote on whether to let women in. The problem is that lots of alumni come back. They're all very anti this. They want Cambridge to stay the same. There's a great picture of a throng in King's Parade of hundreds of people. They've dressed up a woman mannequin in bloomers on a bicycle and hung her from a college building. They're very anti this. And when the vote goes in favour of keeping women out, they get so excited. They go to one of the women's colleges and rattle the gates so extremely hard that the women inside are afraid of their safety. So, you know, they're very keen on keeping things as they are. Other universities have toyed with the idea of what should we continue to have separate education. So the idea of co-education was very alarming to people. So UCL makes great play of being the first place to do co-education, but 2 years before that, it tried to have completely separate education, but in the same building. So what it did is it adapted its rooms so that there was a women's entrance and a men's entrance so that they couldn't mingle in the same corridors. And here's something for the timetable as amongst you. The women's lectures started half an hour later than the men's lectures, so they wouldn't even mingle in the corridors because they wouldn't be milling around at the same time. Clearly it didn't work. UCL went for co-education. Same happened in Manchester. They tried to set up a separate women's college. It didn't really work. They got incorporated into Owens College and then into the whole thing. King's has a separate women's department. They decide it's safer to put it well out of the way and put it in Hampstead. So it's not running no risk of the students mingling at all. So we get those kind of things. Thomas Holloway is persuaded by his wife. He wants to give a large amount of money to a public good. He did want to found a mental hospital, but she persuades him he wants to found a women's college, and he builds another splendid setup. But obviously, in this case, he puts it all the way out of Egg, so far away, you know, to make sure that the women aren't going to have any problem with mingling with the men. There's a debate about how this now should turn. And there's a sense at the end of that 19th century that maybe they should found a women's university for the country. So the University of London would be a university for men, and there would be a women's university. It doesn't happen. We continue on that path. I think what it does is it just shows us that people have had to campaign for change when people think everything is fine, thank you very much. And it's just a reminder to each time to think, hang on a second, are we like the crazy Victorian blokes who think everything is fine, but we're making a huge mistake, we actually need to change.
Now, finally this week, the Office for Students has announced a regional approach to access and participation. Vicky, tell us more.
Well, this was a really interesting moment, wasn't it? So John Blake gave a speech about access and participation plans. And, you know, and he started the speech with a runaround of how the current plans are going. And there was a lot to welcome. You know, they've come out in waves. People can learn from previous waves. Excellent stuff. They're listening to feedback. They're listening to challenges. Brilliant. They're including students in these plans. Fantastic. So far, so good. We're all settling into our seats. Great stuff. And then suddenly, kaboom, out of nowhere, there's a whole new policy, which actually I think is also brilliant, but it's a really interesting way to announce it. So yes, access and participation plans are now going to be devised on a regional basis, and you won't be allowed to submit your plan until everybody in your regional coalition is ready to submit theirs. And they will, I presume, be mutually reinforcing, and they will try to address some of these issues of access and widening participation and social justice on a regional basis. And I think there is a lot in what we've already talked about that leads to this and points to how it might satisfy some of the policy intent grants that the government might talk about, some of those areas of, you know, kind of economic, socioeconomic black spots that you were talking about, Mark. There's a lot to welcome, but a really interesting way to announce it.
Now, notwithstanding the fact that charging the maximum fee is linked to the approval of an APP, and presumably someone in OFS is working out whether any of this is compatible with CMA guidance on price fixing. So let's assume, let's just park that, okay? My little nerdy concern. It does strike me, Michael, that there's, you know, when you meet a group of students and they talk about being assessed with a group project, and they've got a weak link, and they don't know what to do about that one person. You know, is that about to happen?
Well, I feel like when I hear students talk about this these days, it tends to be, you know, they are the strong link, and everyone else in their group is the weak link. You know, and like, why do they keep making us do group work? But it is a sort of policy flavor at this point. It will be interesting to see where the details go. I think it sounds like a really, you know, interesting and quite sort of, you know, labor-y way approach to doing these things. But at the same time, as you say, there are clearly going to be lots of stumbling blocks. It requires cooperation to an extent between institutions which have been geared to compete by the system. I mean, I would also notice he said that there were kind of live discussions taking place with the Department of Education for funding. They want to have some sort of incentive systems and kind of money that can be used for, you know, initiatives around access regionally, which, again, I think would be a sensible way to make it happen and to sort of, you know, overcome institutional inertia. But, it, you know, that might not happen. That money, DfE yeah. may think it's, you know, better spent on further education colleges or, you know, or SEN or all kinds of different things. So it's you know, there's a lot up in the air here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, broadly, this has to be sensible, doesn't it, Alistair?
Yeah, no, I was really, really pleased to hear that the focus on regional. I think it makes sense on two levels. I mean, strategically, if you want a more joined up tertiary education system, paid education system, tackling that regionally feels sort of, you know, pretty sensible, you know, getting HESE employers within a region to work together. So I think this kind of strategically makes sense. But I think it's also a really practical thing here. It's kind of more doable regionally as well. Yeah. So if you look at, you know, in practical terms, what do you do? Well, you want better information versus guidance to students. You want employers to know where to turn. All of that feels more doable regionally than it does nationally, as is certainly in England when you've got, you know, geographically and just in scale, so many providers. So I think a regional approach, you actually could possibly move towards some of the advantages of a more joined up system more quickly if you focus regionally rather than focusing nationally.
Mm. But can I ask you the London question?
Yeah.
You know, if I was a bunch of people that put together APPs, right?
Yep.
And I was meeting colleagues in London, well, at some point, presumably the conversation would move to, it was over 30 years ago that someone decided the maximum maintenance loan should be upscaled by 25% to cover extra costs in London. Yep. That needs to be looked at again. And is it possible that this type of structure will start to surface some of that stuff that doesn't really, you know, we don't really ever hear OFS, at least in public, saying to government, you know, part of this access and participation thing has to be actually supported by some of the stuff DfE does. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, absolutely, there are London-specific issues. I mean, London's one of the greatest cities in the world to be a student in lots of ways, but it's also expensive.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think it is absolutely fair to look at maintenance support. But it's also actually, you know, fair to say that there are certain challenges that universities have for supporting students in London that are maybe different, and some of those require money. But I think that's why the regional approach is nice, because there'll be different challenges in different regions. Yeah. So although I absolutely would advocate for there being unique issues in London universities needing some particular support,
those northern regions are going to be talking about trains.
There are different problems somewhere else.
Yeah.
So yes. So you know. So frankly, transport around London is relatively you know, easy compared to a lot of other cities in the UK, but the cost of, you know, accommodation, for example, is sky high. So
Vicky, is it this, obviously, you know, you go back to item one, you know look at this, look at some of the kind of wider mood music that Labour's talking about, you know, devolution, regions all going to start to become more important, and it does strike me that in particular your work in Wales and Scotland has a particular flavour to it, which just feels more collaborative. And that's not just about, you know, marketisation and funding rules and so on. It's about economies of scale, isn't it?
It's about economies of scale, and it's about policy intent. The work in Scotland and Wales is more collaboratively, because that's the way the whole system is set up. And they are smaller systems, so it's easier to do that way. But that is the way the whole system's set up. It's set up to be mutually reinforcing. It's set up to have the benefit of students right at the very heart of every policy consideration. In Wales, they have this wonderful thing that they can't make a policy decision that will do harm to future generations. Imagine that.
Yeah. How on earth that assessment is made? I am going to go down that rabbit hole for a couple of days at some point. Michael, just before we finish on this, one of the things that John Blake did call out was this potential tension, frankly, between having very little money and giving students, either directly or indirectly, some of the money they might need in access and participation plans. And certainly I've had a look at some of the approved ones that are starting to dribble out.
Yeah, so we've got some of the latest wave of APPs, and your piece on the site looks at, you know, there's some of these institutions where we can see that they're going to be spending less on the sort of APP work in future years. I just pulled that article up on screen, and it says, the total planned in 2020-21 in this group that have published it was 20 million. By 28-29, this will be down to 17 million. I mean, you know, I think this is probably why when announcing it, he said there's going to be some sort of, you know, DfE cash incentives on this, I hope. And, you know, you would, because, you know, universities aren't under increasing financial pressure, can't be expected to do more on access and participation. And, you know, if things constantly changing as well, I think this is the other thing I do get concerned about sometimes, right? That, you know, it just takes an awful lot of work for access and participation teams just to sort of adapt their processes to the new rules, just the sort of, you know, the skills, but also the bureaucracy and the time commitment that is going to go into all of this is, you know, not to be sniffed at. I do really like a lot of what's in all of John Blake's approach, but I do sometimes think, you know, I reckon in 25 years time, we're going to look back on the sort of succession of different access approaches that OFS took and go like, oh, you remember when there was like, we had to do like a risk register? And I was off that year. And I do worry a little bit about, you know, just the sort of, you know, the time that policies take to bed in and the potential for things to be derailed. I mean, this approach is going to be based on sort of syncing up the APP cycles. You know, it's not that long before we get another election. You know, there may be a sort of some, to an extent, a change of leadership at OFS as well. You know, all kinds of things that could happen. It's nice to be ambitious, but yeah, it probably comes down to money in the end.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go deep in anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Alistair, Vicky, Michael, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.
Brilliant.